Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's National Quality Forum conference call. Today's call is being recorded, and at this time I'd like to turn the call over to Ms. Suzanne Taberge.
Thanks. Hi, everybody. We are set to get started here. I think we have a project timeline and next step slides, but we'll save those for the end when we're sure that our slide set is working. Howell will be sending out the link if you haven't received it already for the steering committee members. So with that said, I think we can just dive right in, unless everybody, do you have anything to add?
No. Hi, everybody. Right. It's Reva Winkler. What I'm going to do to help maybe facilitate things is introduce each measure with a brief introduction, reading of the description, a couple comments if necessary, and then ask the person who was assigned to take over the discussion and lead the measures. Do we have our measure developers with us?
Hi, this is Safine Byron from NCQA.
Great. Thanks, Safine. How are you? Do we have anybody from...
Lynn from the CAMI.
Oh, great. Super, guys. Thanks. Okay, and everybody's received an agenda. So the first measure we want to start with is measure 1395. This is chlamydia screening and follow-up. This is a measure from NCQA. It is the percentage of female adolescents who turned 18 years old during the measurement year and who had a chlamydia screening and proper follow-up visit. This chlamydia screening is an important issue for young women. It is a chlamydia screening for women, sexually active women up to age 24, is a grade A recommendation of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. This measure is based on chart review data. To be the level of measurement is at the individual clinician group level as well as perhaps regional network or national level. I would just mention that NQF has already endorsed the chlamydia screening HEDIS measure from NCQA, which is a measure of screening for women, sexually active women between the ages of 16 and 24, and it is stratified for age groups 16 to 20 and then 20 through 24. So that measure is already on NQF's books. So, Sarah Brown, I think this is your measure. Would you like to start the discussion?
I would indeed. I have to preface this by telling you the one chlamydia joke I know, which I can't believe I'm doing, but I had a friend who for years was the health commissioner of the state of Georgia, and she had a state legislature guy one time ask her if chlamydia wasn't the Georgia state flower. I always think when I see this word. That was a nice summary we just had about the measure. It's a process measure at the sort of office physician level. And as we were just told, it's the percentage of female adolescents who turned 18 years old during the measurement year and who had a chlamydia screening and proper follow-up visit. This issue of whether this is important, I think it's absolutely important. Serious, and it's increasing. It's the most common sexually transmitted bacterial infection that we all track. About 20 to 40% of those who are infected experience pelvic inflammatory disease. It's a major contributor to infertility. I noted in this write-up, which I thought was actually quite good, that almost 3 million new cases are identified each year, estimated to occur, although we don't really know because, of course, and there are low rates of screening. So I think there's no question that this is an important issue. There are important disparities by poverty, by race, so forth. I think it's an important issue to think about. There is a little bit of disagreement among the professional associations, including the USPSTF, about the precise measures. Some cut it off at 24, some at 25. And there is a little bit of dissonance in the groups about whether screening should be offered to all pregnant and non-pregnant women, whether they're high risk or not, although most of the measures say it should be offered for high risk women over 24 or 25, pregnant or not, but all women 24 and less, pregnant or not. The measure that's proposed has a two-part numerator. The numerator is whether or not a chlamydia test was noted in the record, did it occur, And then if it was abnormal or indeterminate, was there evidence of confirmatory or treatment? The denominator, as specified, is to only include women with evidence of sexual activity. There is no provision for adequacy of treatment in any way. There is no allowance or nod towards retesting. The reinfection rate is extremely high in chlamydia. That's not addressed at all. No reliability testing was done, but it was judged valid, although in all of these, I don't really understand how this particular sample of 19 physicians with 10 records each is considered a broad enough sample to make any conclusions, but that's a larger question. This measure is not currently being publicly in widespread use, and I think part of the reason is that it's very labor-intensive and burdensome when done, you know, with the paper record. And a note is made that this is probably going to be more feasible, more useful, as electronic medical records become more prevalent. I would just tell you from my read of it as a layperson that I had no question about the importance of this, but I'm worried about several things. I'm worried about the definition and process by which somebody is considered sexually active. And incidentally, there's no distinction made between sexually experienced and sexually active. Sexually active generally means having had sex at least once within the last 3 months. Sexually experienced means ever having had sex at all. And I'm not quite sure what the measure was planning on using, whether it's active or experienced. But it's also a problematic definition just on the face of it about how you determine it, how you ask it, and so forth. As I mentioned also, there is no real discussion in the proposed measure about how to determine whether treatment actually occurred. And remember, the name of this was proper treatment. It wasn't just getting treated, but it was proper follow-up visit. And often a second visit is required after the screening, if it's positive, to come back for treatment. It varies enormously clinic to clinic. But I understand a measure that focuses on was screening done, but I just don't quite understand in a very practical sense how we would determine the treatment aspect of this. And that's not addressed in the measure. Also noted, incidentally, is that this is not to apply to men, which I understand the research is limited, but, of course, that's one of the principal sources of the very frequent reinfection. So that's just a quick overview of the brief.
Justine, did you want to say anything from the measure developer side?
Sure. Thanks. So just a couple notes. In terms of the measure not being in use yet, that's because this is a brand new measure that we have only just completed field testing for. And so we would anticipate that if we put this measure into a program or a product, you know, like our HEDIS measures, they would become widely used. As was noted in the beginning, this measure is actually it's based on the HEDIS measure, the HEDIS health plan measure, which uses that definition of sexually active. And what's different about this measure is that we did add on a specification saying that we wanted to see some sort of, we wanted to see evidence of sexual activity, and then we wanted to see a test result, and for abnormal or indeterminate results, evidence of confirmatory testing, referral, or treatment. So the follow-up items are what's different from the HEDIS measure. Otherwise, it's the same as the HEDIS measure in its definition of the eligible population, which is women who are sexually active, and in looking for a chlamydia test. What you're probably seeing, and I understand the discomfort, is really, it's a difficult thing to be able to define the eligible population for this, as you can imagine. And the USPSTF recommendation asked recommends screening for chlamydia infection for all sexually active non-pregnant women. And so we attempted to build in an algorithm that would get at sexual activity. So, of course, that's not going to be perfect. We've tried to use both an administrative and a medical record review way of doing it, and that is by have a claim for any of these, or do they have documentation of sexual activity or prescription for a contraception, treatment or screening for sexually transmitted disease, pregnancy, or pelvic examination. Obviously, those are not perfect, but it's really our attempt to really define the eligible population here. And so that's just really, you know, I think you're right that EHRs will make it better, but this is a measure that has some administrative component to it to supplement it. So in it has helped health plans to have the administrative component in order to kind of relieve some of the burden, but it is a hybrid measure in that we do require them to go into the medical record. In this particular case, they do have to go into the medical record to see that there was documentation of follow-up, but we felt that was an important piece of the measure.
So what happens to the young women who, I mean, if somebody is screened but not followed up appropriately, and that, of course, can be, they're appropriate, can embrace a number of things, but do you have to be both screened and appropriately in order to get a gold star? Or what if you're screened? Do you get a sort of half a gold star as opposed to no screening at all? Is it a two-level report card?
It's actually, it is that we want to see screening and we want to see a result and we want to see that for abnormal or indeterminate results there's evidence. And we define proper as being confirmatory testing, referral, or treatment. So those three things are our definition of proper follow-up. And you don't get half a gold star. For a lot of these measures, we actually went through and, you know, we went through an exercise with our measurement advisory panel and looked at the results and thought about the field and what's happening and feasibility issues and while staying true to the science. You know, for each of these measures, we had to put the bar somewhere where it would be both feasible and attainable, but also at least a little bit of a stretch goal. And in the case of chlamydia testing and based on the results from field testing, we felt the proper place to put the bar was at seeing screening plus evidence of follow-up and follow-up being defined as confirmatory testing, referral, or treatment.
Okay, and just one last question, then I'll back off here. How about retesting, given the high prevalence of reinfection? Was that considered and rejected?
Well, the measure is testing by age 18, so we're not looking to see that it happens several times. Because the USPSTF recommendation is, it's for, I'm looking for the periodicity, but I believe they say one test
three years.
And so for us, the measure is by the time you reach the age of 18 with the two-year look back, so one test would still, you know, adhere to that recommendation.
Safine, this is Jim Glauber. If you see in the medical record that the young woman has been offered the test but refuses, is that considered an exclusion or a defect if she otherwise meets criteria?
We would not allow for refusals. That's sort of a universal question for a lot of our measures.
Right.
And, you know, I think it's a difficult situation, but because we really want to see that the healthcare provider takes responsibility for that, then there are some cases where we have said refusal might make sense, very rare cases. In the case of this whole set of well-child measures, the one place where we saw refusals as possibly being okay would be in the HPV vaccine because it's so new. And we were seeing a lot more refusals in field testing. In field testing. But for this measure, we did not see that as necessary. We did not see refusals.
This is Elm Lieberthal. I have two concerns about this measure. One, the history of sexual activity is not always accurate. I think the girls and the guys very often deny sexual activity just because they don't trust the doctor, especially if they're seeing a doctor who they're not very familiar with. The second thing is I think excluding males from this measure is problematic because males are the carriers of this, and they're the ones infecting the females.
Exactly.
Right. You know, and I think that you're right, there are some limitations to the identification of sexual activity, and it is something that we struggle with in measurement in general, making sure that we write specifications that can, you know, that can capture the right eligible population. And in the case of this measure, it's been field tested, and it is an existing HEDIS measure. We did not change the identification of the eligible population from the existing HEDIS measure. So it's something that's been extensively tested and that exists now. And, you know, we think that we have a measure that's feasible and it gets as many people as we can.
And as a measure developer, can you tell us a little bit about why it is that males are excluded? Yes, we understand it's based on a HEDIS measure, but in the initial measure development, was that felt to be something that's changeable in the future? Because I think the concern about excluding males is a valid one. And albeit that in males, you would probably only end up with their history, but that's better than nothing. We should try to start to work on males. So what from a measurement development perspective is the thought around the exclusion of males?
For us, and for this measure specifically, it is based on the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, which we consider to be kind of a gold standard for preventive services. The task force gave screening for males an insufficient evidence.
Okay.
So we would not want to build a measure around this. That's why it's on women.
Okay. I had just a couple comments for the group to consider, and that's, I don't know that it makes too much of a difference, but that for the younger age female, the prescription for contraception doesn't necessarily connote sexual activity because they're non-sexual activity-related conditions for which contraception can be prescribed. For example, acne and irregular cycles would be an indication for a birth control prescription. So just to be aware that that's something that would end up in the denominator that might lead to some, not huge, but as you get younger, I think that's a little bit more of a possibility. I just wanted to hear from Reva at the end of our discussion how we would harmonize all of this. We've got one measure, 13 to 18, one under 24, one under 25. I just wanted to hear the different ages again and make sure we don't have overlap and they're all harmonized.
Well, from NCHF's perspective, the ones that we would be looking at is the endorsed measure, which is the HEDIS measure, which is age group 16 through 24. It's stratified into two groups, 16 through 20 and then 21 through 24. So that's the HEDIS measure that's already endorsed. This measure, by my reading, is for 18-year-olds with a two-year look-back, is what Safine says. So that gives you the 16 to 18-year-old slice of it. But this measure adds on the follow-up. So it is a very closely related but a bit different of a measure.
You know, I think the reality is that with the sort of subjective parts of the denominator, as was just discussed, and of course one of the tests is mentioned is pelvic exam, which is not always definitive. But I think if this measure is seen as consciousness raising for a very important condition that is inadequately screened for, I think this would have great merit. I think if it's to be used as a precise measure of what's going on in chlamydia screening and treatment for all women or high-risk women or however it's defined, I think it's much weaker. And I think that's probably something that's faced often in this field, is the consciousness raising and attention valuable even if the measure itself has a few discontinuities.
So
This is Marina. I'm just wondering if the objective here is to replace for this population the HEDIS measure that calls for screening only. Going back to your point, Reba, what seems to be the value added here is the follow-up referral or treatment, correct?
That is the difference between the two.
So then this is a modest, very modest step forward with no correction of some of the underlying deficiencies in the populations identified, the administration of the screen, et cetera. But it is a modest step forward.
Yeah. I would ask Safine how NCQA sees going forward, how they plan on carrying two measures that are closely related but slightly different.
This measure is a physician-level measure that we developed and tested under with our work for looking at a comprehensive well care composite measure. And so this is a piece of the, by the time you reach age 18, have you received these, you know, 5 to 7 indicators for well care, and chlamydia screening is one of them. And so we would not replace the HEDIS measure at this time. We are leaving the HEDIS measure, which is a health plan level measure. For this one, it will move forward and we'll figure out how we're going to further develop, you know, whether or not we've just completed developing the measures and we're considering them for other programs at the physician level for NCQA. And so that's why they're slightly different. And the HEDIS measure stands alone, and it's for health plans. This would really move forward as possibly something that we might put into a physician-level, you know, program, such as maybe a physician recognition program, and it would be specified specifically for physician offices. So it requires slightly different specifications, and because it's part of this well-child composite, that's why the age difference.
Okay, this is Tom. We've spent, I think, a fair amount of time on this, and some very good discussion, very good questions and answers. Unless there's anything really burning from anyone else, I'd like, if we could, to move on again to the next one, please.
Okay. Okay. The next measure is 1407. This is adolescent immunization. It's the percentage of adolescents who had proper immunizations. Two measures are reported, and these will be two separate measures, immunizations by age 13 and immunizations by age 18. The numerator statement is for the first one, children who had documentation and medical record of recommended immunizations by age 13, and then numerator, the second measure, the numerator is the same except for age 18. This is Carol Carlson?
Yes. This measure is a process measure. It is meant to be reported at the provider level, although there's a comment in the notes that NCQA may consider including it in the HEDIS data set, which is typically reported at plan level. The immunizations that are measured are recommended by ACIP and also CDC for mass immunization for adolescents and children. Meningococcal and HPV testing and also the DTaP are being measured both at age 13 and age 18, and primarily age 18 is the more for catch-up for immunizations such as the meningococcal or HPV. Information is to be gathered from the medical record, And I didn't see any note, although maybe NCQA can speak to this, of the ability of providers to include data from registries external to their organization. So maybe we can receive some comment on that. There is for children who would have received these immunizations within the 2 years prior to age 18 for the measurement window. And the measure has been tested by about 190 records for these measures. So it's a limited testing, but it has been tested in offices. That's about it on the adolescent. It does, one other thing, it does mirror the NCQA health plan immunization measure for adolescents under HEDIS.
This is Tom. One of the things that concerns me is it says that it could either be a Tdap or just a TD. And the recommendations now are to have the Tdap. And a TD would not be, in my mind, would not be adequate. Can the NCQA representative explain that, please?
This goes along with the ACIP recommendations, and if that is a recent change, then we usually give a little bit of time before we change the measures because it's it's a retrospective data search. So I would have to look into that. But I believe we have both of them to account for allergies to one versus the other.
And there is no provision in here for parental refusal for HPV?
Right. That's something that we looked into with the field testing, and it could be that we didn't update the form. But we would like to include parental refusals for HPV.
For both ages or just 13? Because a lot of parents will say, I want to wait until my child's a little bit older.
It would be for both ages.
Mrs. Riva, I just want to verify, NCQA sees these as two separate measures, correct, for the 13-year-old age group and for the 18-year-old age group?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And we will present it to the steering committee for voting as two separate measures.
For the HPV, are you specifying females only?
Yes, it's females.
Oh, I couldn't quite find that.
It is females only, and the same argument she used for the Tdap TD is what is written in here, that ACIP recently extended the recommendation to males, but the NCQA wanted to wait some time between the recommendations before adding that to the measure. And in here somewhere. Just so.
Because of the way the data is collected.
Yes.
Okay.
I'd like to hear from some of the physicians on the phone about usability and feasibility. Are there any challenges there that we should be aware of?
This is Alan. Usability, knowing the immunization rate is very important. And feasibility with immunization registries, it should be very easy to collect the data. As far as refusals, you can look at it two ways. A refusal can be documented. It can be documented in a lot of immunization registries, although not all. Or you could just say that the targets for immunization takes into account the generally recognized number of refusals.
I'd say we use multiple immunization measures, and it's one of the more acceptable measures in terms of feasibility and usability. And I think the newer EHRs, Epic, for example, that commands a lot of places, and I've seen some of the others have systems in the electronic record that allow you to defer a vaccine because it's of a parent refusal or out of stock or something. And that's one of probably the thing that impacts usability and feasibility the most would be if there is some unforeseen issue with giving the vaccine, either that it's out of stock or that there is a refusal. And I think many systems have learned how to make that adjustment in the measurement so that it's accurate or accounted for in some way.
Thank you.
Marina?
Yeah.
This is Marlene Miller. I'll tell you, too, we actually have a grant looking at some of these immunization rates. And from a feasibility standpoint, one of the things is the data collection tools, and specifically with respect to EHR. So we have often found ourselves with the gold standard of data, which is the actual dates shots were administered. The rules, at least in the state of Maryland, of how that is requested to be reported is from billing data, which is just counterintuitive if you think about it. So I have, at least in our experiment and our grant, we have found some feasibility issues with this that I don't believe these measures are as friendly to EHRs as they could be in this day and age when immunizations are so well tracked in electronic systems and we don't have to rely on billing data per se to get this information out.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. We're ready to go on to the next one.
Okay. This next measure, 1393, is really three measures, again, of blood pressure screening. The percentage of children who had blood pressure screening and proper follow-up performed. Three measures, blood pressure screening by age 6, by age 13, and by age 18. So, and I believe, Dr. Glauber, you take the lead on this, but Dr. Prasad, I thought you had this when we were...
I had this originally as well.
Yeah, so... We've got two people who can talk about it. Lead on.
Well, I guess I can probably start as I initially reviewed it. This is a measure, as indicated already, that is separated into three age groups, and I believe it's part of the NCQA's composite measurement. By each age, certain things are done. It is a blood pressure, and it's extracted from patient care. So it's a fairly straight measure in that it's a blood pressure, which is already numerical, that you can pick up either from a chart or electronically. The only thing I noticed about this that perhaps is worth mentioning is that there is some controversial evidence, contradictory evidence that is stated in the form, and that's around whether blood pressure screening reduces the risk of cardiovascular disease or accurately identifies children and adolescents who are going to be at risk for cardiovascular disease, and that there is not good evidence to indicate whether treating their blood pressure during the time you find it elevated will actually decrease their ultimate incidence of cardiovascular disease. So the USPSTF didn't determine whether there was any benefit specifically for blood pressure, and it basically ended up, I think, just with an I statement, nothing for or against it. So I think the group should be aware that is in the form. But aside from that, my thought about it was that really it's not only about the blood pressure. It's somewhat of a proxy for comprehensive care, which I think is what the NCQA is getting at with the composite measures, that it's really one of the items in the overall approach to obesity and propensity to metabolic syndrome. And I think that's where there's good evidence that you could improve outcomes if you comprehensively manage the patients in terms of letting them know what their risks are and placing them in interventions. And I think really the big thing is that blood pressure is going to be tied very much to obesity management. So I felt in favor of this measure from the point of view that it shouldn't be considered independently as improving outcomes. It's part of looking after the patient who's obese with propensity to metabolic syndrome.
This is Alan. While I recognize that the studies aren't completed as to the whether control of blood pressure in childhood will decrease cardiovascular disease as adults, it's going to take 20 or 30 more years before that data is really collected. So I think this is one where you have to go on an intuitive basis and say, if a child has high blood pressure now, the chances are pretty good they're going to have high blood pressure. So I think that screening for blood pressure and intervention, whether it be weight control or medication, is likely to affect outcomes later on. But it's going to be so long before we have data that I don't think that could be used as an argument against it.
Yeah, this is Jim Glauber.
Sorry, go ahead.
I agree with everything that's been said. This is sort of like an apple pie measure, but I do have concerns about some of the scientific characteristics of the measure, particularly saying, this is not just looking at a blood pressure measurement, but proper follow-up, and I think that's where there's problematic. So it's easy and cheap, obviously, to measure a blood pressure, but it's anything but straightforward to interpret the finding. You need to, put the measure the child's height and look at their height percentile, and then there's literally a four-page chart from the NHLBI that allows you to determine what blood pressure percentile the child falls into. And one of the studies that was cited in this document is this Hansen study from JAMA, which is a very nicely conducted study from a large health system, where they identified kids in their health system who had three separate high blood pressure readings that were only taken at well visits, so not illness visits. And there's an advantage to doing these at well visits because the child's not sick. And they identified, by these criteria, 3.6% of kids who had elevated blood pressures greater than the 95th percentile on three separate occasions. And of this group, only 26% had hypertension recognized in their medical record as a problem. So, at least based on this study and in my own clinical experience, you can't assume clinicians are going to recognize a blood pressure as abnormal. So I'm not clear how we're defining proper follow-up. Who's making the interpretation that the blood pressure obtained is one that merits follow-up?
This is Gotham Rao in Pittsburgh. I just wanted to echo some of Jim's concerns. First of all, screening and documentation of high blood pressure in kids is a difficult endeavor because you do require that height percentile, and there are gender-specific blood pressure thresholds as well. They seem to recognize that in the measure. They define high blood pressure as being above the 95th percentile for age and sex-adjusted values. But it seems as though the screening, the numerator is basically just blood pressure screening, and it's not clear to me that that includes that second step that's required. The other problem with the measure, I think, is that a lot of, unless something's changed recently, Epicare, for example, which is a common electronic health record, does not include blood pressure percentiles. It does have BMI percentiles. I know the Cerner product, which we use as well here, does not have blood pressure percentiles. And I just wanted to go back to the rationale issue. So the rationale is not only that you take blood pressure in children to prevent long-term cardiovascular disease, and a more important rationale in that very young age group is detecting secondary causes of hypertension, especially renal artery stenosis. So it's important for that reason as well. So I think blood pressure screening is really important, but the measure itself doesn't capture the complexity of documentation that's required.
As far as Epic goes, I don't know how difficult a change it was to make, but in the Kaiser version of Epic, we do have blood pressure percentiles, and in our smart sets, we highlight the blood pressure percentile, and we have a decision assist for if the blood pressure is over the 95th percentile. So I know that it may not be in most versions of Epic or Epic off the shelf, but it is available in Epic.
Yeah, I think that's really something, because we've been asking Epic for more than a year to try to incorporate that. So it'd be great if that was disseminated more widely.
In the numerator details, it actually says documentation must include a note indicating the following, not just that it was present in the EHR.
Right.
So I'm agreeing with all the prior comments that there's some questions about.
Right, but the EHR would ideally provide the decision support that's required for proper documentation. So the fact that a physician documents blood pressure, for example, is not all that helpful unless there's additional information they need at the time of care.
I agree. I mean, and I was agreeing with you that the way I was reading this is that it wasn't just, it was a note. That
right.
It would have to be in a note drafted by a physician.
Yeah, right.
And I also spoke to a pediatric nephrologist who's a hypertension researcher, and he referenced a study that's not yet been, it's been submitted to the PAS meetings, but you know, in his work, he said that the majority of kids who had an abnormal reading didn't have another follow-up blood pressure within the following year. So he feels like mild degrees of blood pressure elevation aren't necessarily or commonly recognized. With this measure, we could conceivably be giving people credit when they're not recognizing an abnormal result.
Right. This is Tom, and I think the key to this measure is in 2A.3, the numerator details, and it says, for abnormal or indeterminate results, evidence of confirmatory testing, referral, or treatment. And that, I think, is very important because we, in addition to whatever else is said, there is a fairly high incidence of sort of white coat hypertension. And, in fact, if you repeat the blood pressure on two or three more occasions, you may find that the initial pressure was abnormally elevated, and they don't have a problem. But I think the idea of getting to the evidence of confirmatory testing, referral, or treatment becomes the most important part of this measure.
It seems like some of these issues must have been come out in the pilot. So I would be curious from NCQA how all these issues were dealt with.
Yeah, exactly how, because is it the person assessing the chart that made the determination of whether the blood pressure was normal or elevated and therefore needs a second test, or was it the provider understanding that something was not normal with the blood pressure? And they're really two different – they're two completely different things, because if the assessor isn't the one making the determination and only making the determination if the chart says it's abnormal – then we don't really know whether where the blood pressure was screened, whether that was assessed against a standard, the blood pressure high percentile charts.
Yeah, I mean,
kind of
I
like the BMI. There's a difference
right.
between just recording a BMI
mm-hmm.
and recording the BMI percentile.
Exactly.
I think that's what Jim was getting at as well. I think that physicians quite often don't interpret the blood pressure measurement correctly or not, whether it's, I mean, it's almost always going to be taken. And that's really where the improvement could take place, I believe. Even if they document normal, or normal blood pressure, you know, that would at least tell us that they're interpreting the measure, the blood pressure correctly.
This is Sarah. I wanted to ask a lay person's question. If there is elevated blood pressure from repeated measurements and all the appropriate interpretations, how successful is treatment?
First of all, there are pretty well-defined guidelines for management of high blood pressure in kids that came out at the same time the standards came out. So there's a wide variety of medications that can be used for treatment.
And it depends as well on the patient. If it's a secondary cause, many secondary
right.
causes have treatment. And usually in the secondary cause, the treatment of blood pressure overall decreases morbidity and mortality. For the primary causes, that's where it gets into the issue of, you know, does bringing down a blood pressure alone decrease cardiovascular risk? It's probably going to be a combination of blood pressure and fitness and weight, all having to work synergistically to decrease cardiovascular risk.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, one of the big questions is the person who is evaluating the chart, do they have the appropriate method to determine whether the blood pressure is elevated or not for that patient's age and height and sex and height percentile?
Do we have a developer on the phone to answer any of these questions about
yes.
that?
Safine?
Yes, this is Safine. I've been listening to the questions. As far as documentation, we originally specified the measure, and it was really, you know, we didn't specify it as a percentile. We just noted that there should be a blood pressure result, and then for abnormal or indeterminate results, some evidence of confirmatory testing, referral, or treatment. We did leave it, I think, to the physician to just say, okay, it was abnormal, and to document it. We did hear back from some of the chart abstractors after field testing that they would have liked some guidelines or guidance on just what you're talking about, you know, whether or not it really was abnormal or not. Often they would just see a blood pressure reading, and, you know, if nothing was followed up, it could be okay if it was not a raised level, or maybe it wasn't, but they really couldn't tell. And so this was actually a measure that we were doing some further investigation into some of these issues that you were talking about, using the height and weight and the percentile. It could be that we need to adjust the specifications to, say, a blood pressure result and then refer to some evidence that there was, you know, that the result was compared against a percentile chart by NHLBI or some sort of you know, I could see us specifying it that way to get at some of these issues.
See, I think this is a really big problem because, you know, hypertension in kids is underdiagnosed, so you're going to have a lot of physicians who document a blood pressure but don't recognize it as being abnormal, and that's going to be adequate according to this measure. I mean, the real problem is how carefully or how accurately blood pressure elevations are interpreted in children.
And to this point, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm done. Go ahead.
Oh, you know, Dr. Sinako, the nephrologist, said, you know, it partly depends on whether the point of the measure is to identify kids with primary hypertension and will have milder degrees of elevation, or to identify the rare kid with secondary hypertension who he felt like most any pediatrician will be able to look at that blood pressure with their naked eye and say, that's something I need to act on. If the point is that we want to identify that broader group of kids with milder degrees of elevation for, you know, risk factor and lifestyle modification, then we really need to see evidence that people are making reference to the NHLBI percentiles.
Right. I mean, that point is well taken, and the point of the measure is to see that all kids receive some sort of blood pressure screening as part of, you know, comprehensive well care. And so I think we possibly could consider adding some specification to the measure saying that they compared it against percentile charts and guidelines.
I think that's probably the first place that we really need improvement.
That's correct.
That's probably the first measure that should be, did you get a blood pressure and did you compare that to the percentiles to determine if it's normal or elevated.
Right, and that's the same thing, and someone had mentioned, I believe it was you, about percentiles for BMI and how it was the same issue, and that was why when we did create our BMI measure, we did make it a percentile. And I think after field testing, we have seen that that's probably something that needs to happen for this measure, and it's something that we have been in talks with our measurement advisory panel on, and we're doing some follow-up research at the time that we had to submit these measures.
So are you saying that the measure developer is amenable to adding the percentile ranges?
Yes, we are.
Very good.
Sathine, this is Reva. I want some clarification. When you provided under 2F.3 the scores from testing or current use, for each age band, there are three results. Which result is actually this measure? Because you have screening documented, and results in proper follow-up documented. And so which one is the actual measure result?
This measure put it different ways. As I noted from earlier, you know, we always wanted to figure out where are. For this measure, it would be the last one, screening and results and proper follow-up documented.
Okay.
So that's the higher bar. So just screening documented, you can see, you know, for some cases it was 99%. So everyone's doing a blood pressure screening. It's pretty standard. And so this is one where we wanted to raise the bar and push them to results and proper follow-up documented.
Thank you.
So I guess a practical question, should we wait on a new document to vote on this measure? What should we do around voting for this measure?
Can't we just condition our vote, just say in the notes that our vote is conditioned on the addition of the percentile ranges?
That sounds good.
You can make it a conditional vote, yes.
Okay.
On addition of the specifications to include the percentile.
Good. All right, I think that's helpful for that one. Now, number 1385.
Okay. Now, for the next group of measures we're going to discuss, these are measures that are based on survey data, and this is information obtained from parents. For those of you who are with us with the Outcomes Project, you remember that we saw a fair number of these. This first measure is the developmental screening using a parent-completed tool. The measure assesses whether the parent or caregiver completed a developmental screening tool meant to identify children at risk for developmental, behavioral, and social delays. The items are age-specific and anchored to parent-completed tools. The age-specific items assess whether children 10 to 71 months are screened. This measure is part of the National Survey of Child Health, if I got that one wrong. There is data in here describing the measure as an independent measure, the specific questions from the survey that are pulled out. They also describe the evaluation of this as a standalone measure so that the appropriate questions could be pulled out and applied in other surveys or other uses independent of the National Survey of Child Health. It's also a subset of another measure from CAMI, the PHDS, and what else is there? I think that's about it. Who is... Faye Gary was not able to be with us to lead the discussion, and I'm hoping I can impose upon some of the other members of Workgroup 4 who reviewed this measure to begin the discussion. And we do have the measure developer on the line with us.
This is Alan. I just want to ask a question. Are these measures intended as population measures or health plans or providers?
Go ahead.
This is Colleen from the CAMI. This is a population-based measure that can be assessed at the national level and then also stratified at the state level. Separately, the items are included in the Promoting Healthy Development Survey, which has already been endorsed by NQF for health plan level and provider level measurement.
Thank you.
Sure.
So this is Jim. This would always be a parent reported measure, correct?
Yeah, so we have other measures that have been submitted from CAMI and NCQA
right.
that are based on medical chart. The reason the title of this measure is Developmental Screening Using Parent-Completed Tools is because parents have been shown to be valid reporters of when they complete a parent-completed tool. And in looking at data from the Ensuring Better Child Development program and from the Developmental Screening Project led by the AAP to guide and inform the recommendations, over 95% of providers that are doing standardized developmental screening in their offices are doing it using parent-completed tools. So we're anchoring ourselves to that type of screening that's the most prevalent and used due to time issues in practice.
And I do believe that in the in-person meeting, we did pass a measure that is at the provider or practice level for standardized
yes.
tools.
Yeah, that measure is based on claims and medical charts.
How reliable is this tool?
We did a significant round of testing based on funding from the Commonwealth Fund, where we implemented the survey with parents who were in practices that are doing standardized developmental screening, and then implemented it in practices of parents who are in practices that are not doing developmental screening, and saw good sensitivity and specificity with the item. Again, because we're anchoring it to the standardized screening tools that are parent completed, parent recognition about these tools is pretty high.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments about the measure?
Are any of the physicians on the phone using this tool? Are their offices using the tool?
This is Tom McInerney. Not that specific tool, but there is a HEDIS measure about developmental testing that is being used. Do you remember that, Reva?
We looked. I have to go back and look at them, frankly. Do you have the list, Suzanne?
Excuse me. My screen is frozen. So that it doesn't advance beyond the very first measure description. And this wasn't in the material sent in late October for Group 4.
No, these were sent to you after the meeting.
On what day? Do you know?
I don't know.
We sent these probably about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
This is Sharon Dougherty. I just wanted to make the comment that I use a lot of parent report measures in my research for children that are medically fragile, chronically ill, and have found parents to be very valid and reliable reporters of their children's behavior and developmental stage acquisition.
Yeah, Tom, this is 1399 is the developmental screening by 2 years of age. The percentage of children who turned 2 years old during the measurement year who had a developmental screening and proper follow-up between 6 months and 2 years of age.
Yeah, that was the one she just mentioned.
That we passed.
Right.
And this is Colleen from the CAMI. We sent a table actually kind of describing you know, there's a number of measures on developmental screening that have been submitted, and the differences between the measures are the unit of analysis. So this one's at the national and state level, and then that NCQA one was at the health plan level, and then NCQA also submitted a provider level one, and then CAMI and NCQA submitted another claims medical chart level one for the state level.
Right, and we worked together to make sure that our measures were aligned and harmonized.
Yep.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Colleen, this is Ellen Schwalenstocker, and I wondered if you could say anything about, you know, what do you know about the implications of pulling out specific items from surveys, and what does that do to sort of the validity and reliability of the measure, if anything?
This scale, independently, we tested on its own and within a survey. There sometimes are biasing effects when you, depending upon where you place survey questions. So for this item, we didn't see differences in terms of ordering. The PEDS items, for example, you might see a difference of whether you've talked about anticipatory guidance before or not. We would not recommend that someone it's a STEM question with two follow-ups. The item, the scale would not be valid if someone independently took specific items out and didn't keep the scale in its entirety.
Okay.
The rates that we've seen, too, were kind of had high face validity. We just had a paper accepted into Pediatrics actually describing these findings in the national survey, and there was high face validity in that North Carolina and Minnesota looked the highest in the national surveys, which is what you would expect given their significant screening efforts. And states that weren't part of the ABCD Screening Academy had low screening rates. So because this is a CHIPRA core measure and because there's a strong focus on developmental screening nationally, the ability to be able to maximize and use the national surveys to be able to track this outcome at a population level is pretty beneficial. And so given that this scale could fit well into the national survey and the findings are similar to what we've seen in terms of face validity at the provider and medical or health plan level, we think the scale is good to keep within. I mean, it's worked well depending upon where it's been placed in the national surveys.
This is Jim. In terms of disparities, what was your experience of making this inquiry of parents who are either not primary English speakers or low socioeconomic status? Did they report as accurately as other parents?
We primarily did the testing with Medicaid only because given our primary focus, the CAMI's primary focus in having it be part of the Promoting Healthy Development Survey, it had to be at the 6th to 8th grade reading grade level so that Medicaid agencies could use it. So most of our testing was with low SES populations. We did significant cognitive testing in Spanish to ensure that the items had validity for that population. We weren't funded to do cognitive testing of the items in additional languages, although the National Center for Health Statistics did translate the items into different languages and did initial runs of the items based on their initial testing that they always do with the national surveys and didn't see issues.
Okay, great.
We did see disparities by groups within the national survey findings as well.
So Tom, we're running a little bit behind.
Sure. So I think we can hopefully now we can move on then to work group three measures.
Sure. Okay. The next six measures that we're going to talk about are all from the same national survey for children with special health care needs. And these are measures submitted as independent measures, and we'll need Colleen to tell us more about them as independent measures versus measures that are embedded within the national survey. This survey is given every 4 years, and Colleen, am I right that it's 2009-2010 is the most recent implementation of the survey?
Yeah, I'm actually going to let Scott answer since he knows the most from the CAMI about the national surveys.
Fine.
Hey, this is Scott Stumbo from CAMI.
Hi, Scott. How are you?
I am good.
Okay, so the first measure we're going to discuss is 1343. This is children whose family members had to cut back or stop working due to child's health. The measure assesses whether a family member had to cut back or stop working due to the child's health condition. This is a measure of in which a screening group of questions is used to determine whether the child qualifies for the denominator for special health care needs, and then the questions are asked to determine the numerator elements. So, Dr. McInerney, I think this first one is yours.
Yes, it is. So I looked at this one pretty carefully. I felt that this was an important measure because it certainly is important to know family members who are not able to work because of their children's chronic illness. However, some of the issues which affect this measure are really more societal and not necessarily within the medical care system itself. But nonetheless, I think it is important. I felt that the scientific methodology 2A, B, and C were completely met. As you mentioned, the denominator is children with special health care needs up to age 17. And the numerator, the parent answered yes to either question C9Q10 or C9Q06, and which essentially that they had to cut back or stop working because of their child's illness. However, from 2D to 2H, there were no answers supplied by CAMI. I did feel, though, that this was a scientifically acceptable methodology on the whole. On usability, although I think it meets the usability criteria partially because it is measuring societal as well as medical factors, and it really doesn't indicate the contribution of each of those factors to the reason why the parent is not able to work. And then as far as the feasibility, I felt that this partially met the feasibility criteria in that this is a somewhat complex data set and survey and is, I think, pretty expensive to administer and is available every, 4 years or so. But all in all, it, I think, provides over time a measure of how well the medical care system and society as a whole are able to help children with special health care needs. And it would be interesting to see the changes in the percent of parents who or caregivers who need to stop work. And hopefully with health care reform, we might see that those numbers decline, but who knows?
Any other comments from anyone on the committee?
This is Alex from Children's Los Angeles. Quick question for the CAMI developers. So what's the purpose, what's your goal for this particular measure?
So given that this is a population-based health measure, we see this as, you know, having extreme policy relevance. And even though the previous speaker was just saying, you know, that this is not maybe falls outside the medical realm, although we don't believe that anything related to policy and policy decisions around medical care leave and or healthcare reform are certainly within the medical realm. So we see population-based health measures especially important to setting policy at both the federal and state level. So these surveys have been replicated by a number of states as well. These are national surveys which have, you know, random sampling within each state. And Colorado and Texas and other states have done state-level samples where they can then get county-level data as well. So clearly there's a relevance to both state policymakers and national policymakers.
Right. My question is that this particular issue has been, certainly I've seen it in the Children with Special Health Care Needs chart book that illustrating this issue. Paul Newarchuk has published several papers on this particular issue. So I don't think it's not being made aware at either the national or state level. I'm just wondering what's the purpose in terms of are we trying to track it every 4 years? What does the measure actually add to what's already been known or published?
That's correct. We see population-based health measure endorsement as endorsing the use of the measure every 4 years, and also the use for state and other people to get their state-level data. So you're right that the results have been published, and therefore, but not everyone knows that state-level data and stratified risk groups are also available.
This is Jim.
I have, I guess, a similar question, or maybe the same question asked again. I completely understand the value of this measure descriptively, but I'm still even trying to understand what the right number is. Is it better if people cannot work and take care of their kids, if they can afford to do that, or is it that they're supposed to be able to have a child with special health care needs and work fully? Now, this is a big issue, but as an accountability NQF-endorsed measure, not just a descriptive measure that requires a lot more unbundling, I'm still trying to understand the purpose of tracking this metric as described with as little detail as is there in the measure now, what you're trying to accomplish.
And also, this is Jim, this measure, by being asked every 4 years, is not being asked in the context of a static economy. So how people might respond would, I would think, depend on whether we are in an environment of low relative unemployment versus where we are now, and families being under more financial duress, and perhaps workplaces having less willingness to accommodate for families with ill children. So given that the economy is varies over time, can you really glean from an every 4 year survey the policy implications that you want to get out of this measure?
Well, I think that's the contextual. Any time a survey is done, you have to know what's going on at that time. I would say that the questions are worded such that the idea is to get at specifically cutting back or stopping working due to having to care for a child who has a chronic illness. So I don't think it's anchored to the economy, although that clearly might be in people's minds, because that could be.
I would just say, having this, Marina, worked in a policy environment and both the executive branch and legislative branch at the state as well as the federal level, that this type of kind of high level, maybe 30,000 feet measure, is useful to policymakers for purposes of allocating and directing resources. They can not very precisely, but in a rather crude way, and to them perhaps the most acceptable way, mix and match different cohorts of the population and make some rough judgments about the allocation of resources. And so I will say that in a policymaking environment is a very useful snapshot to have, albeit it would be even more useful if the survey were done more frequently.
So, what type of resources?
Well, for example, if you're looking at the SSI population and you're trying to make some decisions about allocating administrative resources for purposes of determination of eligibility for disability benefits. Are you going to be deploying more pediatric specialists or geriatric specialists or people with extensive experience with adolescents, et cetera?
But is that to allow the mothers to go back to work?
No, with SSI, it would be.
That's part I'm not. I'm just missing the link to.
If I could, I think part of the what's the attempt to accomplish in these national surveys with state level data, is that it gives you standardized look across all 50 states using the same tools, to be able to make policy recommendations both at the state and national level. So I think the important thing to the asker of the question is that this gives comparability, so we can say which states are where parents are having to cut back more. Possibly it's due to policy, possibly it's due to insurance. You know, you can stratify by insurance and other family level variables in the data set. It is certainly not to be intended to or imply, you know, at any kind of individual family or mother level, as was just suggested. You know, does that allow the parents to go back to work? For example, we just wrote a 100-page report for the Packard Foundation in California, and this is one of their most favorite findings, was this variable, which showed that roughly 300,000 kids with special needs in the state had parents who had to cut back or stop working. Well, that translates to, you know, millions of hours of lost work. And so it has extreme relevance at policy at that level as well.
Do you have any idea of the types of conditions that have forced parents to cut back?
I don't have that data right in front of me.
Okay.
Yep. Certainly those with more complex needs, I can say it very generally, are more likely to be the ones who've cut back. You know, one of the screening items on the Children with Special Health Care Needs screener are those who are sort of limited in function. They're usually typically the highest need kids, and those kids definitely have parents who have had to cut back more than others.
Okay. And let me say, again, that working with decision makers at the agency level, this is, again, a top-level kind of look, and they would not be making very costly decisions on the basis of this one data element alone. This kind of points them in a direction where perhaps further inquiry is needed.
This is Carol. While I agree that this information is exceptionally helpful for budget and policy making decisions, I'm still confused on how it directly correlates to outcome in health. I mean, can we always say that if there's a reduction in hours worked in the home that there's a negative impact on the health outcome of a special needs child? I'm not ready to agree to that.
You know, this is Sharon Dougherty. The only comment I want to add is that I think there's also a health disparities component to this, that oftentimes the families that these children are born into can be families that have had poor prenatal care, families that are already depending on two incomes. And so I think that the data is important, and I do think it impacts, the data is important to understand the kind of care that's required in planning for follow-up clinics for these children and their families. I feel it is a really important variable.
This is Ellen Schwellenstecker, and I don't argue at all that it's not an important measure, but I'm really having trouble understanding why actually most of the survey needs to be endorsed by NQF. It just seems a little outside of the scope of NQF endorsement, kind of going back to use for public reporting and accountability. As I understand it, it's a survey that is administered every 4 years, and NQF endorsement is not likely to change that. So I guess I'm just having a problem understanding, you know, why we need to put each of these items through an endorsement process.
Well, I want to echo that, and I'd like to put the question to the NQF staff. Did you guys just put these on the list because they were submitted, or was there any kind of a decision made internally at NQF about whether these were appropriate for NQF endorsement in the first instance?
Okay. Marina, it's more the second. There's been any number of discussions on this, and there are a couple of levels. One, these are population health level measures, and population health is, as you know, one of the National Priorities Partnership goals and priority areas. So And the question, and I think there are still some outstanding questions that we need to get our hands around in terms of what do we mean by population health measures and what do we intend to do with them? How will they be useful to us? So I think we're still exploring some of that. So that's why population health measures. We have also had conversations, several actually, with the developers, kind of trying to figure out how these might fit. And particularly looking at these as individual measures, because as you should recall that we looked at many of them in the Outcomes Project, and in fact put forward 9 or 10 of them for endorsement, and since that's happening as we speak, this is something that we've sort of already kind of gone down this road. There's been a fair amount of back and forth discussion about, you know, the survey with all of the measures, is that a sort of single entity? And apparently the measures that have been submitted as individual measures have been evaluated and tested and validated as individual measures so that they could be pulled out and potentially used on their own. So that's why the individualness of the measures. I think all we have tried to look at all of the different aspects of the question you posed, which is fairly complex, and I don't think we have all the answers yet, and your discussion is helping us. We actually took these questions to the CSAC in November for their guidance, but, you know, at the end of the day, these are measures that provide information using a different data source than we're typically used to. These are population-level measures. They are different than what we're used to, and we're still trying to understand how they kind of fit into the entire umbrella.
This is Jim. Thank you for that context. I'm just noticing that conditions for consideration by MQS, it includes both under C purposes, public reporting, and internal quality improvement. And it seems that with respect to this measure in particular, this is more of a hypothesis-generating measure rather than something that could lead a health delivery system to internal quality improvement, because there are so many contributors to why the periodic measure would change every 4 years. So I don't see how it could lead to quality improvement. It certainly would raise important questions to try to understand why the measure might have decreased or increased over 4 years.
Jim, was your comment specific to this particular measure, or?
Well, this more so than the other ones, because
okay.
You know, some of the other ones pertain more to what happens in the healthcare environment.
Well, I just have to tell you that, again, speaking from the consumer community, it's enormously useful to have information about what, again, top line, about what states are doing with regard to children with special health care needs, you know?
Right.
In some states, families can both parents can continue to work without having to cut back, because policy-level decisions have been made that create and sustain programs that are being used by families to help care for their children.
And insurance coverage is a big one.
Yeah, well, so. Insurance coverage and you know, some of these kids require medical personnel to be on site, too. So.
Sure. All right, well, this is Tom, and I think we've had a very rich discussion on a measure that's a little bit different from some of our other measures, but a measure that I think many people feel is important. And I want to remind everyone that we now have a little bit less than a half an hour. We have reached the halfway point in that we've considered 5 measures. We have 5 to go, so I'd like us to try and press on here at this point, please.
Okay. Generally, the next 5 measures are all have the same sort of context, and is in that they're all survey measures from the same survey. The question I would pose to Scott for all of them is, are these measures tested and validated for use independent or outside of the National Survey for Children with Special Health Care Needs. So that will add. But the next question is, and the next is 1340, children with special health care needs who receive services needed for transition to adult health care. And this one, I believe, is Dr. Rao.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, this comes from the same survey, and it's a three-part measure that is comprised of discussion about change in health care needs, discussion of continuity of insurance coverage, and discussion about self-care responsibility. And the developers make a very strong case that these children are not only vulnerable, but that time period in their lives, the transition to adult care, is a very vulnerable period in which we can influence their overall health. In terms of the actual measure, it was a little hard for me to understand the precision with which the numerator is defined. For example, doctor discusses changing health care needs, and I wasn't really clear if it, there were some examples of that that might be helpful. The doctor discusses insurance coverage. That's fairly straightforward. And the self-care component, I would think some of these children have a limited capacity for self-care. The actual mechanics of how the survey takes place was a little difficult for me to follow, whether it was actually the parent or the child or both who were interacting with the surveyor. But essentially, I think that, as I think it was Jim or Tom who said before, I mean, this one is definitely well within the realm of healthcare delivery and isn't necessarily a reflection of economic hardship or some societal factors like 1343 was. So I think it's a very important measure, but I'd like to hear a little bit more from the developer about perhaps the specific questions parents are asked to validate the measure.
Before we go to that, it's Alan, I just wanted to ask, is this intended for a population measure, or will this go to a provider measure?
Alan, this is Riva. These have all been submitted as population-level measures.
Okay.
Scott, are you there?
Sorry, I'm here. I had you guys on mute, and I was talking. These are all population health measures. Those are great questions. This one, I have to say, of all the items that come out of the National Survey of Children's Social Health Care Needs, this one is particularly well sought after by lots of state and national policymakers because of the fact that, trying to get adolescents ready to transition to adult health care is such a huge field. Everything in these surveys is parent-reported, so I'm going to make that blanket statement, and hopefully that resolves that one outstanding issue. And if it wasn't framed that way in the measure, I apologize, because this is all a parent of surveys. I mean, a survey of parents. So this is to assess whether or not the parents report that they and their child received these three types of transitional guidance, one being did they discuss the healthcare needs as the child becomes an adult, and one was about health insurance was the other one, and then the self-care. So I don't know, do you want more details than that? I mean, they're fairly broad screening questions, and if there's a filter question and then you get follow-up saying whether or not that discussion like that would have been helpful to you, and so if you didn't get it and you said that would have been helpful to you, then you didn't meet the numerator for having received proper transitional guidance.
So, as you mentioned, this is all parental report.
Yeah.
And so if the physician had a conversation, not with the child, but with the parent, about, for example, transition to adult care, would that qualify? Because the way the numerator stated is if child's doctor only treats children, the doctor had conversation with child, but eventually seeing other health care providers who treat adults. So if that conversation didn't take place with the child, would that be sufficient?
Yes.
Okay.
And this is Jim. Thinking in terms of medical homes, it doesn't seem to me that it's necessary that this conversation be had specifically with a doctor as compared to some other caregiver within the medical home. So do the questions really specifically focus on the doctor, or the receipt of this type of support?
All the questions are framed as doctor or other healthcare provider.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And go ahead. Sorry.
This is Kathy. Could you help us understand why it starts at age 12?
There are items that go to a younger set, and we, because transition, we think, you know, starts most intensely in the adolescent years, we sort of stratify it only to the 12 to 17 group.
This is Alex from Children's. I can help with that. There was like an expert consensus committee meeting maybe last year on this topic, and they felt that the earliest age that we can help kids of, I guess, providers and provider team accountable would be age 12. Obviously, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that transitions should start as early as possible, maybe even around 8 or 9 years of age. At least the concept of planning it with the family should start that early. But the actual transition planning and actual physically identify providers and or transition services, the expert panel felt that it can only be as early as 12.
And apropos of the question about medical home, you know, because of the medical home variable, which was recently endorsed by NQF, also exists in the survey, you're more than twice as likely to receive this transition planning if you receive care within a medical home. So it's 56% versus 28% of youth. So, yes, in fact, having a medical home is an extremely important indicator of whether you get transition assistance.
Scott, this is Rita. Is this measure been evaluated and validated for use independently of the entire national survey, or must it be part of the national survey?
I don't have the evidence of whether it's been validated outside the national survey. I know that other states have used most of the national survey, again, like Colorado, Texas, Puerto Rico, have used the survey, but I believe for the most part they're using it in toto.
All right. Anything else on this measure? Can we move on to the next?
Sure.
Okay. Measure 1331, again, a measure from the National Survey for Children with Special Healthcare Needs. Community-based service systems are organized so that families of children with special healthcare needs can easily use them. This is the numerator is the percentage of children who had difficulties trying to use community-based services. And community-based services include any services that children need because of their health. This is Dr. Clark.
Yes, you're correct. This measure, I think, is certainly less well worked out than the one we just discussed. And in terms of the importance to measure and report, the only comment on the application is it affects large numbers. And so they also cite the national survey that we've referred to before. And I went to the national survey, and I guess I'm not totally convinced that the numbers are large enough. For example, the number of children with needs that needed specialist physician care that did not receive it was 2%, and that was 388 out of the 20,150 that were in that group. 732 received some of the care that they needed, and the weighted estimate is out of 5 million children nationwide. That means that 100,000 did not receive any of the care needed. That doesn't seem to me to be a real high impact. Now, some of the other needs that I looked at, the one with the most numbers had to do with physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy. And in that group, the number that did not receive any care was 3.2% out of the 7,000, well, about 8,000 of the population surveyed. That was 267 children, and the weighted estimate was that about 2 million children nationwide potentially need it, and that would mean that 74,000 approximately would not get any, and 237,000 would get some of the care that was needed. And I guess I was not very impressed with the importance part of the application, and I don't really think the case has been made that this is important enough to measure. And I also wonder, it's already being measured with the national surveys. As far as the, it's also, it's not been tested at this point, and testing is supposedly to be done within 12 months. I didn't really have a problem with the science. I didn't really have a problem with the usability, except for the fact that I'm not sure that it has a big enough impact, and I'm not sure that, the room for improvement is real great, because most children are getting what they need. As far as feasibility, I think it's obviously feasible, because the methodology appears to be quite similar, if not identical, to the national survey, which I would say kind of has been tested. And so my only objection at all is that I don't believe that the importance to measure section of the application has been adequately addressed.
Any other comments?
This is Alex. I just have, I think this is a very hard outcome to measure, particularly on a survey. There's so many factors that go into kids who have issues accessing the care that they needed, both from a medical provider's perspective and also from the system's perspective, as well as other enabling and or barriers that a family, so social, economic circumstance may determine. And so having a measure that basically uses sort of parental rapport to assess whether or not these are adequate or not, I just find it very difficult to place any faith in any of the results that it will show you. I mean, I think it will give you sort of a face validity of what happened or what's not happening, but I don't know if it really means anything, particularly in every 4-year cycle, because there's a lot of things and policies that will change, both at the state level and the national level. So just kind of to follow up on what Jim had commented before.
And I would agree with that, and plus the, I think that the section where they responded, they received some of the care, but not all of the care. And that, from the parents' perspective, I'm not sure they would know. If that's their opinion, maybe they didn't think the specialist spent enough time with them or whatever.
Can I offer a couple of comments?
Sure.
Just three things, but none of which are to debate the actual measure. I want to address a couple of the more general points that were just made. I would dispute that this is not affecting large numbers of children. I mean, I wasn't quite following all the numbers that the gentleman was describing on my own website, because I'm not sure which exactly he's referring to, but this is roughly 1.5 to 2 million children with special health care needs, which I dispute is not a lot of children. So I think that's just a very general comment. On the second comment, in terms of what is the validity of this, why would we not care about what parents think are easy-to-use services for their children? And can someone offer me a better measure of what that would be rather than asking parents? And thirdly, I would say that this is their opinion, again, just gets back to the whole issue we've been around several times now about parent report.
So if people would like me to address it again, I will.
This is Alex. So I actually did a lot of focus group on children with special health care needs and their parents. And I think parents are these parents face a lot of issues. And you know, believe me, I have no higher respect for these parents than anything else. But, you know, some of the issues, I do trust their view in the sense that it is what they perceive as being issues that's causing them problems. But some of the issues are, you know, let me give you an example. In some of the focus group that we have, one of the biggest concern or comments or that parents or complaints that parents have about accessing some of their service within the hospital setting is parking. At least, you know, in our own patient population, that is one of the major issues. But parking has nothing to do with insurance authorization, with insurance availability of services, availability of appointments, their ability to get to the appointment. It really has anything to do with anything. But some of those parents would actually said they would have issues accessing services that was not made easy for them because of parking. And I'm not sure that is reasonable to expect states and or other policy agency to address that particular issue. I mean, it's certainly an institutional issue that I've taken up with my own institution, but I'm just not sure who should be responsible for that.
And this is Jim. Perhaps part of the difficulty to Alex's point is the way the question is phrased. Not to dispute the validity that this is important to these families, but we're saying had difficulties trying to use. And would it not be better to ask, were unable to access needed community-based services? Because phrasing it this way could mean, you know, you had trouble, you know, getting through on the phone, or, you know, you were on hold for a long period of time, but you ultimately received the services. So, you know, it seems like the bottom line is families who are unable to access services. Yeah, I won't dispute that we agree that there are better ways to measure this. I would still dispute, I think, saying that parking is driving this, I think, is really underestimating the value of parents. It reminds me of the conversation we had when looking at insurance adequacy, which was recently endorsed by NQF on the outcomes measure. And, again, several committee members said that's just their opinion that they don't have adequate insurance. And so I think saying it's just their opinion or they're only thinking about parking is it's unfortunate.
No, I mean, I think
I don't think
there are two different levels of issues, right? Insurance adequacy is a pretty simple, straightforward issue that they can actually perceive and handle and navigate. But services is a lot more. There's a lot more depth. I mean, that's the whole point about the whole field of access to care. It's not just insurance coverage. It's everything. That sort of is around it, you know, on top and below it, you know, it's basically the whole argument about demand versus and potential access versus realized access. But insurance adequacy, I think I can actually believe that parents can make a very valid comment about that because they are facing it every day. But accessing services, I think, is just a lot more complex than just insurance adequacy.
All right.
I might just clarify or respond to the numbers issue. The numbers that I quoted were directly off of the survey results website, which is a project of CAMI. So they're numbers that came from CAMI.
Speaking from the consumer perspective, this is Marina, I'm having a problem understanding the question because it appears to go to the issue of systems and the organization of systems on a community basis. And if this data is being collected statewide, then I would assume that that would vary considerably across even a single state, would it not?
Oh, most absolutely.
So then what? How useful is the information that you glean from the answers that you're getting here?
Well, I mean, if you think it's interesting to know, let's say, I don't know the exact numbers for each state, but let's say you had 20% of parents in California reporting that they had a hard time accessing services and only, 8% in Minnesota. So again.
But unless you know which communities are doing a good job and therefore can get at the issue of how they've organized their system, I'm not sure that that data tells you much. Now, again, speaking from a consumer perspective, I couldn't agree more that it's important to get a measure of whether or not these kids are able to get services when they need them. But I just don't think this question is worded in a way that gets at what I believe you're trying to discern. So I think the goal is good. I'm not comfortable with the question.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Understood.
This is Reva. Because we're just about to the end of our two-hour time frame, we do need to make time for public comment. So are there any other final comments for the measure that we're going to end with, the 1331? If not, operator, could you open the lines and see if anybody has any questions at this point?
Yes, ma'am. All lines are now open.
Great. Does anybody got a question out there?
This is for the Gallagher.
Hi, Rita. You're breaking up. I really can't understand you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is this better?
Yeah.
Okay. Only to say that it's critical as this work moves forward that consideration is given to the use of all-inclusive language so that it's clear that these services in many instances are being provided beyond physicians.
Thank you, Rita. Anybody else have a comment? Okay. Well, we didn't get through three of the measures, so we'll start up with those when we reconvene again on Friday. And now I'm going to let Suzanne kind of wrap things up for us.
So I sent out a survey link by email before the call, and I'll go back in and revise that survey to remove the measures that we didn't get to this afternoon. You can't submit the survey without voting on everything, so I'll go through and remove those, and then you can vote on the measures that we did discuss, and we'll also revise the agenda for Friday and send that out tomorrow.
Does anybody have any questions about what we're doing, our call on Friday, and then the call again? We'll have another call on December 17th.
Reva, this is Safine from NCQA. Mm-hmm. I just had a process question.
Yeah.
When are these being voted on?
After the call via survey.
I see. Oh, that's what the survey is. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Tom, anything last from you?
No.
Marina?
December 17th.
I've been filling.
Oh yeah, have that. I have that. Okay. Does everybody have that on your calendar? December 17th at 3:00.
Yes.
Good. Okay.
For that call, once we finish the calls this week, so we know what we have left to discuss, and then we'll have that agenda finalized next week.
I'm sorry. Great. Could you say that date and time again?
It's December 17th from 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time.
Okay. I don't have that on my calendar. Okay.
Anything else from anybody? If not, thank you very much for your time. And
thank
we will
you.
Regroup again on Friday.
Goodbye, all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Talk to you Friday.
Bye-bye.
Bye.